Welcome to the New World. Episode 7, Five Governors. Last time, I took a break to talk about John Cabot and his attempts at exploration in North America. Now I want to jump forward again to the death of Christopher Columbus in 1506, with the Spanish Empire poised to conquer the whole Caribbean. I'm going to be speeding up a bit as events spread out across the sea and new territories are taken, but let's start where we left off, on the island of La Española. Things were going well for Governor Ovando. After rebuilding his new capital of Santo Domingo, he had set about imposing his will on the remaining Tainos of the island, while also increasing its infrastructure. He burned towns in the far east and west, and put down new towns in their place, settled by the now thousands of people arriving from Castile. This had been a common practice in Spain since the days of the Reconquista. These towns had grid layouts with churches, town halls, and prisons, a plan that many Spanish American towns would follow. He cleared land for fields upon which European animals like cattle and horses and swine now grazed. A variety of goods were being imported to the island, the most valuable of which was labor. Since Taino labor was being increasingly unreliable due to rebellions and, general resistance to enslavement, Ovando had a massive haul of 100 African slaves sent to Hispaniola. The history of black enslavement in the Caribbean starts here, and it will be a long and bloody history. Despite Ovando's material success, he had many enemies. One of these was Cristobal de Tapia, who accused him of preferential treatment of appointees from his home province of Extremadura. Tapia was a victim of this himself, having been replaced as commander of the fortress in Santo Domingo in exchange for one of Ovando's friends. He also accused Ovando of misallocating Taino slaves to his personal friends as well. When Ovando heard that Tapia was spreading rumors about him, he jailed Tapia. However, the royal government, which supported Tapia, ordered his immediate release, and King Fernando had Ovando replaced. Who is his replacement, you might ask? Why, it's none other than Diego Colón, son of Cristobal Colón, the old governor and discoverer of Hispaniola. After Columbus died, the king ensured that his wealth and title of admiral was passed to Diego, his one legitimate son. In 1508, 2 years after Christopher died, Diego was appointed viceroy. Looks like the Columbus family is back in business. One final note. In 1512, the so-called Laws of Burgos were passed in an attempt to improve the lives of the natives and to make them be seen as equal to Spaniards. These contained some provisions which improved Taino working conditions, and even allowed Taino children to learn trades. However, there were other laws which required all Tainos in Hispaniola to be forcibly converted to Christianity. Their babies were to be baptized upon birth, all deaths were to have Christian funerals, and Spanish landowners were supposed to ensure that all this happened. However, it also required some other things. Native towns were to be burned down, and the natives were to be reallocated to more newly built Spanish ones. Dancing, drinking, and body painting were prohibited due to their religious significance in local culture. European clothing was also required for all locals to wear. It's obvious that the Laws of Burgos were a clear attempt to destroy Taino culture, or at least fully integrate it with Spanish culture so as to make it unrecognizable. If you want a good example of cultural genocide, look no further. So let's leave Hispaniola there for now, and take a trip just to the east, to the island the Tainos called Boriquen. On August the 12th, 1508, Juan Ponce de León landed on the southwest coast of the island, with about 50 people. As you might have expected from his last name, he was a nobleman, the son of the Duke of Arcos, who had taken part in the Reconquista in Granada and the conquest of the eastern part of Hispaniola, for which he earned his own encomienda estate. With the affairs on that island settling in, there was nowhere else there to burn down and plant a Castilian flag on. So for seemingly no other reason than opportunism, Ponce de Leon convinced the then still governor Ovando to give him a force to conquer and settle the island of Puerto Rico. Accompanying him were several conquistadors, including his son Juan González Ponce de Leon, who acted as a Taino interpreter, and a free Portuguese black man named Juan Garrido. Juan González is our source for the journey. The party of the Ponce de Leon family had their settlers encamp on the far west of the island at Aguadilla. Here, Juan González traveled around to the local caciques, talking to all of them. They were pretty friendly for two main reasons. Firstly, they probably didn't know what the Spaniards had been up to on Hispaniola, just across the water. Secondly, they may or may not have actually suspected that the Spaniards couldn't be killed by normal means. This was according to a Spanish historian from the time named Oviedo, so I'm still skeptical. Regardless, after several friendly meetings with the caciques, including gifts and territorial agreements, Ponce de Leon and his son got back on their ship and traveled around the coast to what was even then known as the Bay of San Juan. However, according to Oviedo, during the trip, a group of Tainos decided to test their hypothesis that the white men were invulnerable and held a conquistador underwater for a few minutes. When the man, of course, died, the rest of the Tainos apparently were convinced to go to war with the Ponce de Leon clan. This was the start of a brutal series of skirmishes that would kick off a war between Ponce de Leon and the people of Boriquen. For example, in an attack on the settlement at Aguadilla, Juan González sustained 36 arrow wounds and still survived. The end of the war only came when they engineered the capture of 17 caciques and had them shipped off to Santo Domingo as hostages. Ponce de Leon, now the master of Puerto Rico, made his capital at San Juan and began placing the conquered Tainos into encomiendas and, of course, into slavery. Not long after, though, Diego Colón came to Santo Domingo to rule as governor. He may or may not have known that Ponce de Leon had royal permission by now to be in that governor's seat. Whether out of ignorance or just playing dumb, he announced that he didn't like Ponce de Leon in that position, so he tried to replace him. However, while Diego was playing political checkers, Ponce de Leon was playing 4D chess. When the replacement, Julio Cerón, arrived and tried to kick him out of San Juan, Ponce de Leon had him arrested and shipped off to Castile on a boat belonging to a friend. He then magnanimously appointed a friend of Diego's to be his chief magistrate as a show of good faith. Not only could Diego not replace him, but he also couldn't complain to the king about it since Ponce de Leon was a royal appointee. Juan felt pretty proud of himself, I would imagine. But the government in Castile decided that they actually liked Julio Cerón. They approved Colón's appointment and confirmed Cerón as governor. This sounds like Ponce de Leon got kicked out of power, but this didn't exactly happen. He'd established Puerto Rico's government, and pretty much everyone still in power owed it to him. When he would come back to Puerto Rico after a brief trip to Florida, he would find the island still loyal to him. These political games allowed the Tainos to assert themselves once again. A cacique named Aguebana organized a rebellion of some 3,000 men, who protested the literal enslavement of their people and burned some haciendas. This rebellion failed and was cruelly put down. A few years later, in 1515, there were apparently only two caciques left in power, Humaco and Daguao. These men rose up again in one great revolt after they were conscripted by the Spaniards to fight the Caribs to the east. However, this rebellion also failed. Humaco and Daguao died, and by 1516, there was no one left in power in Puerto Rico but the Spanish. When Ponce de Leon was let go from governorship of Puerto Rico, he decided to mount an exploratory expedition. In 1513, he set off with three ships towards a place they called Bimini, but we know of as Florida. On Easter Sunday, they landed in Palm Beach, and traveled further down the coast towards the Gulf of Mexico. Especially on the agenda of Ponce de Leon was to find the so-called Fountain of Youth, an idea which had been floating around since the days of Sir John Mandeville in the Middle Ages. It was supposed to heal wounds and restore old men to youth, but Ponce de Leon soon discovered the key to eternal life was not to be found in the Florida Everglades. After making a quick pass over by the Yucatan Peninsula, he returned home to Puerto Rico. The governorship of Diego Colón saw even more expansion of Spanish colonies in the Caribbean. Juan de Esquivel landed in Jamaica in 1509. If you believe our contemporary writer Oviedo, he pacified the island with some force, but with chivalric discipline and fairness. If you believe our other contemporary writer, Bartolomé de las Casas, he trumped up excuses to conquer the natives and forced them into encomiendas as soon as he could. His successor, Francisco de Garay, brought European livestock like horses and pigs and cattle that quickly overran the island's unprepared ecosystem. With the colony on Jamaica being established, the Spanish now used it as a base to launch two simultaneous attempts to colonize the South and Central American mainland. One was led by a man named Diego de Nicuesa, who sought to found a colony and also find a supposed hoard of gold that Columbus had alluded to on his fourth voyage. He founded the colony of Nombre de Dios, but the search for the gold went nowhere, and Nicuesa almost died. The other venture was run by Alonso de Ojeda, a veteran of Columbus's voyages, who had set up a colony near present-day Cartagena in Colombia in early 1510. The Spanish and natives had shared a brutal encounter there before, and conflict began again almost immediately. However, the natives lured Ojeda's men into a trap and slaughtered almost all of them in one ambush. Among the few survivors were Ojeda himself and the bastard son of a noble named Francisco Pizarro. It was truly a disastrous defeat. Ojeda's new colony, San Sebastian de Uraba, would have surely failed immediately had it not been for the arrival of some 70 criminals on a stolen ship to supplement the settler population. However, it was not to last. Ojeda himself left to go get help within a few months, leaving Pizarro in charge with instructions to leave himself if Ojeda didn't return in 50 days. Ojeda did not return. After the 50 days, Pizarro departed with the settlers, but he came across a man named Martin Fernandez de Enciso on the open sea, who encouraged him to return to the colony. They wanted to do so, but found it already burnt to the ground by the natives. Enciso and Pizarro were thinking of what to do next, but just then they were approached by a third man. This was Vasco Núñez de Balboa. He was a conquistador, but he didn't actually belong on the ship. He had stowed away in a barrel with his dog to escape angry creditors in Santo Domingo, and he proposed sailing to Darien in modern-day Panama, a place Balboa had visited on a previous voyage and had insisted was much more fertile and less dangerous than San Sebastian had been. Pizarro and Enciso might have had their reservations, but the crew of Enciso's ship had already been swayed by Balboa's apparent knowledge of the region and incredible charisma. So to Darien they went, and the settlement of Nuestra Señora de la Antigua del Darien was founded. They sent a search party to Nombre de Dios nearby, and they found a few colonists led by an emaciated Diego de Nicuesa, who agreed to join them, but began to assert that everyone in the colony actually worked for him now, since his appointment was for this area, which was true. Balboa, who had somehow won over the whole party and was now the de facto leader, instead sent him packing back to where he came from. Nicuesa sailed off in a ship and disappeared from history. Balboa also expelled Enciso and made Pizarro his second in command. By December of 1510, he had received approval from both Diego Colón and King Fernando to become official governor of the territory. From barrel stowaway to governor. Talk about a social climber. However, Balboa proved himself just as ruthless as any conquistador. He searched for gold and forced natives into submission wherever he went. Rumors spread of massive hoards of gold hidden away in the Andes Mountains to the south, the start of the myth of El Dorado. Balboa also sent home pineapples and a strange root the natives called batatas, but we know of as potatoes, or some form of it. Balboa also sent home plenty of falsehoods. He claimed this: "In the province of Darien, we have discovered many and very rich mines. There is gold in great quantity. We have discovered 20 rivers, and there are altogether 30 which have gold, which stream out of a sierra 2 leagues from this villa. Certain chiefs have gold which grows like maize in their huts, and they have it in baskets." This was not true. Darien, even today, is a difficult place to live, and the gold did not flow like rivers. Balboa was actually quoting a native who had told him all of this beforehand. He hadn't actually seen it himself. He had also been told that this kingdom lay near a sea to the south, which no European had ever seen. So while King Fernando himself financed an expedition to set sail for this golden land, Balboa set out with about 200 men to actually find El Dorado. As I said earlier, Darien, this region of modern-day Panama, is a very difficult place to live. It's an even more difficult place to cross by land. Even today, there is no road that goes straight through it between Panama and Colombia. If you want to get from North America to South America, you have to take a boat at some point. Mountains, forests, and rivers just make it too difficult. And this is all what Balboa had to deal with on his march inland. He was helped along the way, actually, by natives that he had managed to trade and ally with in exchange for guides. In September 1513, Balboa found something. It wasn't a city of gold, however. It was a sea, a vast sea, which appeared on no known chart. Balboa and his men took this to be confirmation of what the native had told them and celebrated. They didn't find any gold, however, instead taking some by force from an unfriendly cacique who stood in their way. Still, Vasco Núñez de Balboa found himself the first European to set eyes on the Pacific Ocean, at least from America. However, back in Spain, things were turning against Balboa. King Fernando had heard of Enciso's expulsion and decided to make the captain of the new expedition, Pedro Arias, the new governor of the new province of Castilla de Oro, or Golden Castile. Pedro Arias, as he is better known, was the 60-year-old former page of 2 Castilian kings and the husband of former governor of the sister of the former governor, Francisco de Bobadilla. You remember that guy, right? His expedition would be the largest Spain had sent west since Columbus's second voyage, made of 23 ships and about 2,000 people of every background and function. One of his pilots was even the nephew of Amerigo Vespucci, the guy who the whole continent was named after. They landed in present-day Colombia for a rest stop in June 1514, and read a declaration to curious natives that the land was now the property of Castile. This was met with silence, as none of the natives understood Spanish. Carrying on, they landed in the Bay of Uraba, where Balboa's colony lay. Balboa greeted the man set to replace him warmly, probably because he knew that he was about to be placed on trial for kicking out Enciso, and probably causing the death of Nicuesa. You remember the guy who sort of disappeared after Balboa expelled him. The judge decided that Balboa's leadership skills overruled any crimes he may have committed, and decided to give him a fine. Darien only had about 500 people living in it when the expedition arrived. Tripling its population overnight would be a serious challenge. Starvation and tropical disease immediately started to lay waste to the settlers. Pedro Rias sent men out in all directions to look for gold, men who also laid claim to the lands that they found and upset the local natives. Pedro Rias also constantly quarreled with Balboa, who had effectively been named his second in command. Over the years, they sent expeditions throughout modern Panama, looking for gold and good places to settle to fix their overpopulation issues. Eventually, this rivalry reached a point where Balboa may or may not have been actually attempting to found his own colony on the Pacific coast and effectively secede from Pedro Rias. The governor sent Francisco Pizarro to arrest Balboa and accused him of treason. On January 1st, 1519, Balboa, the man who left for Central America in a barrel, was executed by firing squad. That's where I'll leave the story of Spain's Central American colonies. The Pacific Ocean had been found, but there was a lot of failure, betrayal, and false promises to get there. Let's step back a bit again. In 1509, Diego Colón gave Diego Vázquez de Cuellar permission to conquer the island of Cuba. The 44-year-old Velázquez was from one of the old medieval Spanish families. His ancestor was the founder of the Knightly Order of Calatrava, of which Governor Ovando was a member, which may have been the reason why he was appointed to a prominent position in the Hispaniolan colonial government. He assembled four ships and 300 men in modern-day Haiti. Among these men were some very important figures. There was Juan González Ponce de León, the man who had much experience conquering Caribbean islands by this point. There was Pedro de Alvarado, who would later be the governor of Guatemala. Also along were his personal friend Bartolomé de las Casas, who in 1508 had become a priest but was still caught up in the excitement of, you know, colonialism. And lastly, there was one 30-year-old Hernán Cortés, who was now acting as a secretary to Velázquez. In 1511, they finally set sail and landed near modern Baracoa on the far east of Cuba. Not long after, they captured Hatué, a cacique who had met them in battle. They offered him a conversion to Christianity and a subsequent burial once he was executed. Hatué replied that if heaven was full of Spaniards, he preferred to be unbaptized. So he was burned at the stake. The conquest of Cuba was a sure thing. The Tainos there were few in number, and they were unused to warfare regularly. Certainly no match for the professional soldiery and the steel weaponry of the Spanish. The conquistadors pressed their way westward, conquering the island village by village as they went. One instance in Las Casas' writings sticks out here. He went out ahead of the army to a village to convince them to submit to the Spanish and provide them with food, something he had been doing multiple times. The Tainos offered them extra food, but with the condition that they were to remain outside of the village, while the commander, a man named Narvaez, considered what to do. One of the conquistadors simply started killing. The other conquistadors joined in, and soon the whole village was being sacked and burned. Las Casas, horrified by the sudden orgy of violence, only managed to save about 40 people from the slaughter. Afterwards, he approached Narvaez. "What do you think of our Spaniards?" Narvaez asked. "I offer you and them to the devil," Las Casas replied. After this incident, he would find himself strongly opposed to Spanish treatment of Native Americans for the rest of his life. By 1513, Cuba had been taken by the Spanish completely. Diego Velázquez, now Governor Velázquez, ruled the island for about 11 years. During this time, he founded many of the island's biggest cities, including Trinidad, San Salvador de Bayamo, and of course, Havana. All of these were founded on the sites of previous Taino villages and built with native slave labor. The Tainos themselves were divided up and parceled out to Velázquez's companions, the new aristocracy of Cuba. As with many other Caribbean possessions of the Spanish, when there weren't enough Tainos to enslave, black slaves were imported from Africa. Let me cap off this episode with a note. King Fernando of Aragon, the man who's been with us since the start, finally died on December 23rd, 1516. I don't have too much to say about him that I haven't already said about Queen Isabel. He oversaw an era of imperialism, but also laid the foundations of the modern Spanish state. His heir, the 16-year-old Charles von Habsburg, would define the next 40 years of European politics, becoming one of the most powerful men in world history. You see, Charles was not only King of Spain now, but also Holy Roman Emperor and Duke of Burgundy. He had much of Europe under his thumb by 1519, and he would soon have much of America as well. In the 1510s, there were five major governors in the Spanish Caribbean: Diego Colón in Hispaniola, Diego Velázquez in Cuba, Juan Ponce de León in Puerto Rico, and Juan de Esquivel in Jamaica, and Vasco Núñez de Balboa in Panama. We see different stories for many of these men, from the highborn Velázquez and Ponce de León to the more self-made Balboa. All of them were mostly after the same thing, though: riches and power. They conquered the lands they settled and used military might and enslavement to build up their new colonies. They were ruthless to a man and oppressed anyone who might have stood in their way. We can see in these men the template for the stereotypical conquistador who sets out into the jungle to look for gold and cares not who he has to kill to get it. The men who will soon be conquering empires, Cortes and Pizarro, will follow their example. Spain has expanded its reach a great deal in this decade, but soon they'll find themselves masters of the Americas.